Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network, and welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to welcome back Melinda Myers. She's the author of more than 20 books on gardening, including month-by-month gardening, among other things. And it's always great to have her with us to answer your gardening questions. And I hope you'll join in as we visit with her maybe we'll talk about varieties. We can talk about seeds and getting them in the pots. We can talk about whatever your little heart desires. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Melinda's with us by phone. Hi, Melinda.
Hey, good morning, Larry. How are you?
Well, a little bit of a cold, but otherwise I'm doing great.
Well, that's good. That's good. This weather sure has made us appreciate our gardens, I think.
I'm frankly looking forward to the weekend. We've got Garden Expo.
That's right.
Here in Madison. Shelley Ryan and I are going to be giving a little presentation at 11 o'clock tomorrow at the Garden Expo. And I think Lisa Johnson is going to join us as well. So that's always a lot of fun. And, the expos like that are just so much fun because even though it's cold and snowy outside, it's sort of like springtime.
You bet. I'm heading over to the Home Improvement Show, the NARE Home Improvement Show here at Milwaukee. And so if anyone's in the area on it, too, I'm going to be showing beautiful pictures of the gardens we can look forward to. And like you said, it's just a breath of fresh air, even if it's artificial at this point.
Well, that's for sure. Well, what are you getting these days in the way of questions from all your fans?
Well, I think a lot of us are concerned about the weather, the snow load, the salt damage, the winds, the really extreme temperatures. If there's anything good to say about the snow, and there wasn't a lot of good things to say last week when we were all shoveling out, but it's a good insulation. It's the best mulch we can do. Nature can take care of plants better than we can. And so I think the best thing sometimes for us to do is just remember that the plants have done very well without our help for a long time, and that sometimes we cause more damage trying to take care of and protect our plants. So, with this heavy snow, obviously, if you can shovel first and salt second, if you have broken branches and damages, I'm a big fan. I'm a certified arborist, but I don't do big tree work. I know my limitations.
Yeah.
And, if you've got big trees that are damaged, you want to call a certified arborist, someone who's voluntarily been certified, who's trained and has the proper equipment and know how to really take care of large trees. Because I always worry when people ask me about pruning large damaged trees, and I think, oh, they're going out there with a chainsaw on a tree, and it's not a good picture. So, save your, you'll probably in the long run save money and your health and your trees. And so that's what I'm hearing a lot. And then you mentioned starting seeds, and a lot of people, I think, are getting the itch, and a lot of people are doing seed starting. And a lot of people, I've been talking a lot about growing microgreens indoors and get a little bit of greens from your windowsill, and it seems to be popular and catching on right now.
So, plenty to talk about.
Pardon me?
I say, so plenty to talk about.
Oh, you bet. It's gardeners, and they're your listeners, Larry, so you and I are, never have to worry about.
No, we don't. And as a matter of fact, Pat in Madison's online and has a question or comment. Hi, Pat.
Hi, I have a huge and prolific Annabelle hydrangea.
Okay.
I would like to divide it.
Right. You can do that in good sharp spade in the spring. I was talking about doing something in late winter, and everybody looked at me. And I said, yeah, that may be June this year. I call late winter when the snow's gone and you can get out in the garden, not by the calendar. But when you can get out there before growth begins, if possible, and when the soil's workable, get out there with a good sharp spade, and then you could either just dig a chunk off to move. If you need to move the whole thing, you can dig out the whole clump, depending on how big it is, and divide it into pieces that way. And depending on how old, it usually responds pretty well to that kind of division. They are suckering shrubs, so they'll send out new shoots, but you'll need a good sharp spade, or you may even need to have a handsaw handy to cut through. When you're doing your dividing to cut through those rhizomes.
Oh, that's a good idea. I do have a suggestion. You talked about a window box or or
microgreens and
microgreens.
Right.
I had very good luck this last year with two basil plants.
Oh, wonderful!
One is the pistou basil, and the other is the boxwood basil.
Oh, that's a pretty one. That
and they make a small small bush that you can maintain in a relatively small pot.
You know, and that's, you know, you bring up a good point, Pat, is windowsill herb gardens have been around for a long time, but I think sometimes we forget some old traditions, and with so many people going into locally grown food, the slow food movement, growing our own, you know, winters get long, and having, even if you can't get the locally grown produce you want, and, you know, it's not as tasty as when it's right out of the garden, using some homegrown, even if it's in the windowsill herbs, is a great way to add some flavor and zest. So good point, Pat. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Pat. Appreciate it. Valerie in Madison has a question for you.
Hi, Valerie.
Yes. Melinda? Yeah.
Hi. My husband and I, we want to grow some blueberries in a raised bed, and I know that blueberries... let me shut this off, need a little bit more of a acidic soil.
Right.
I'm just wondering what type of composition we should put in our raised beds and if you could recommend any hardy plants for the, you know, the Wisconsin or Madison area.
No.
Yeah. One of the things...
It's a hard thing.
I don't know, Larry, if you remember Dr. Mac Dana. He used he was a fruit professor, and I actually was lucky enough when I was working on my master's to take a class from him. And he lived in the Mequon area the last part of his life. And
but
he
this
had,
is Madison, by
this,
the way.
I know. Oh. But, I mean, we have very alkaline soil.
Right.
And he grew blueberries, but thanks for the reminder, Larry. He grew blueberries as a hedge in his front yard. Now, here's the thing. You're right. They do need acid soils. Both of us, Madison and Milwaukee, have very alkaline soils. I've got a blueberry in the back. Any organic matter, by adding organic matter, compost, peat moss to your soil, isn't going to greatly lower the pH, but it will help.
Okay.
The other thing you can do is use acidifying-type fertilizers. A low nitrogen, slow release, something like, you know, you've heard me talk about Milorganite, and the reason I like it is an organic form of nitrogen, so using organic sources of nitrogen, again, will help keep the pH a little bit lower, and it also has iron, which is helpful in a chelated form. The other thing is North Sky, Northland, the Extension Service has a great publication for anybody in Wisconsin. There's one for northern Wisconsin and one for southern Wisconsin. It's Fruit Cultivars for Southern Wisconsin and Fruit Cultivars for Northern Wisconsin.
Okay.
But Northland and North Sky are pretty available throughout Wisconsin. Monrovia is a pretty popular ornamental wholesale nursery that sells to a lot of independent garden centers, and I know they were selling it. Those are both self-fertile, but if you use two, you'll get a better fruit production. The beautiful flowers, the fruit obviously are great. You may need to wait a year and keep your fingers crossed because Larry's right. It's, it's not going to be like growing tomatoes and good fall color. So it's a nice ornamental plant. And, you know, the fruit's just kind of an added benefit. So if you did a planting of them, you may want to put them someplace where you can enjoy their beauty and not just their fruit, too.
Okay.
All right.
Good. But it's worth a try. They're really, it's fun.
And you need to kind of keep at the acid side of it.
Thank you. Good point. Using organic mulches, shredded leaves, again, using acidifying type fertilizers, those are things that will help keep it that way. And if you can collect rainwater, the pH of our, because our bedrock is limestone in southern Wisconsin, our pH of our water tends to be high, so it's like liming the soil. So if you capture rainwater, it's going to be neutral to slightly acid, and that's, you know, an added benefit if you need to supplement nature.
All right.
Okay, sounds great. Thanks.
Thanks so Val, for calling. Appreciate it. Carol in Salem, we are on to you. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. Well, I was interested that you were talking about microgreens because I just read this big article about it. And what I was wondering is that really, I mean, I like to sprout seeds in jars with water.
Yes.
Are microgreens, like, better than that?
Well, you know, that's a good, you know, I can tell we're of the same era, you know, a little flashback here. I have sprouting jars, too, that I use. One of the things, the benefit of, both are very good. The benefit of the greens is, you don't need to rinse it twice a day. And so if you're a person that gets very busy or travels, and if your sprouts sit in the jar and you don't rinse them regularly, you know they can kind of get, you probably don't, but some people have experienced moldy sprouts. So the benefit of the greens is you're growing them out of a seed starting mix or a well-drained potting mix, and then you just clip them so you don't have that contained environment. So they're similar. It's just a different way of growing them. I do both. And I do a lot of work with kids, and so I like to do a little bit of both, so I have them experiment and do them. So whatever's easiest and works well for you is great. The one that I never had until last year was sunflower sprouts. And I'll tell you, if you're trying to get kids to eat sprouts, I did a workshop with kids, and I brought already sprouted sunflower sprouts. Really kind of tastes like the seeds, very kind of nutty flavor, very good. Those kids ate those seeds up like crazy and couldn't wait to grow their own and take them home. So, you know, that's one of the things. The other thing I want to mention, since we're on microgreens and sprouting, and you already know this, but others who are new, you want to get either organic seeds or seeds sold for sprouting. So you know they haven't been treated with any chemicals or anything that, you know, seeds that are meant to be planted in the ground versus eating the sprouts. You just want to make sure that you're picking something, purchasing something geared for that or chemical-free so it's safe to eat.
There we go.
Thanks for the question. Good question.
Thanks a lot for calling, Carol. Let's turn to Mary next in Belleville. Mary, hi.
Hi. I wanted to add some comments about raising blueberries. I've done it for about 20 years.
Excellent.
And I've found that I like Patriot as a variety because, one, it's never died on me. Secondly, the berries are big enough so I don't have to bend way over and get little berries.
I like your gardening style.
Yeah, which is true of the north, the half-high northern varieties. They tend to be small and difficult to pick. Secondly, we have trouble with rabbits gnawing through the trunks of the blueberry bushes. So we have to protect them every winter. That's important. And finally, they need a steady supply of water in the summer, so we mulch ours very thoroughly. And also, I have a slow drip kind of watering system for them, and that produces crops which are enormous.
Wonderful. Good points. And, you know, one of the things when I mentioned about capturing rainwater, if you do have rain barrels, one good way to empty them is to use a soaker hose attached to them and let gravity take care of it. So combining your idea of a drip irrigation, because you're right, you want highly organic soils, which will hold moisture, but you do need to water them. That's a good way to supply the water. And what was the name of the cultivar? I didn't quite hear you on that one that you grow.
Oh, Patriot. It's about four feet tall in our garden. And heavily loaded every year, and it has large berries, really big ones.
And where are you located in Wisconsin?
Belleville.
We're in Belleville, but we are out in the country in a valley, and we get colder weather than Madison does and colder than surrounding areas. So Patriot works well here.
Excellent. That's really good to know. Usually half highs, like the ones I recommended, are a little bit hardier because of the snow cover, but it's always good because I find gardeners are the best researchers out there. So thanks for sharing it. That's great.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. Visiting today with Melinda Myers on Garden Talk. Judith Sears-Poisson, our on-air producer, regular producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will take your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or via email at talk@WPR.org as we visit with Melinda Myers. Melinda, we have an email from Ann in Appleton. She says, I was given a hibiscus last June. It blossomed indoors through December. That was when I noticed tiny deposits of whitish stuff stuck onto the little crevices of the buds and leaves. I washed the plant carefully to remove them, but they're back. Whatever it is, killed one of the two plants in the pot in December. Help!
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like if they look kind of cottony, it sounds like mealybug. And mealybugs are a common problem indoors, as are spider mites. There's some other soft scales like mealybugs that tend to be a little whitish, but these kind of look cottony, and they don't wash off easy. A couple of things you can do. If it is mealybug, take a cotton swab, dip it in alcohol, and touch each individual one. It dissolves that cottony filament that protects the insect from water and pesticides, and then it'll kill the insect underneath. Then you can follow up with insecticidal soap or a lightweight horticultural oil labeled for indoor plant use. They're both eco-friendly and safe. And then what you're doing is trying to kill the immature ones before they put that covering on. If it's more of a hard shell scale, that can kind of, there are some that are kind of grayish white looking, scrape them off with your thumbnail or an old toothbrush just to dislodge them, and then do the soap or oil treatment, and that will take care of the immature ones. White flies really fly. So, you know, they look like tiny little white flies, and when you touch them, they fly away, usually in a large group. So if it was white flies, they would be moving, not stuck in the crevices. It scale and mealybugs are tough. You need to be persistent and keep after them. And once you remove them, the plants usually can survive and thrive. And once you put them outside, they'll recover pretty quickly. What happens is they suck plant juices, often secrete the excess as a clear, sticky substance called honeydew, just like mites and aphids, scale, white flies, and the mealybugs all do that. And then they're feeding stresses the plant, causing the leaves to yellow, causing leaves to brown, and sometimes even drop off. And even if they've dropped all their leaves, your hibiscus might be okay as long as those branches are pliable. Just try to get that mealybug or scale, whichever it is, under control.
There we go. Let's go to Ron in Madison next. Hi, Ron. Thank you for calling.
You said the magic word arborist. I have in my hand an application to work as an arborist.
Excellent.
And number five question says, tree care equipment operated and maintained, including model number and length of time operated. The model number is an impossibility for me. I've been planting, pruning, spraying, and harvesting trees and shrubs for over 40 years. I have no clue what the model number of the stuff I used as a teenager might have been. I do know the two farm tractors were Model H. One was manufactured in 1941, and the other one in the 50s. But, you know, the other antique equipment that I used back then has probably been in the recycling mill or in a landfill for 20 or 30 years, and I have no way to come up with a complete list. And if I did come up with a complete list, it would never fit in the 19 column inches that they allow for the application. I mean, is this just a way to screen out anybody that hasn't worked at the same place for 10 years?
Well, I think that's such a trend. And I think one of the things is there's a saying, and the arborist profession is a chainsaw and a picket do not arborist make. And I think a couple of things. It's one, to look at the experience you have, making sure your idea of an arborist and someone else's are the same. And then also I think it's a good indication of what that employer is going to have to do to train you. So I would probably call there, but if I was having done a lot of hiring in my past, I think what they're probably looking at is, did you use a 18-inch chainsaw? Did you use a, you know, to give them a sense of the type of equipment that you've used, even if you don't have the exact model number. And I would probably start with the more modern equipment. Just to kind of make yourself look, you know, current and up to date. Not that you're not, but I understand you've got a long, long history, and you know, that definitely you want to reflect that. But yeah, I think they just want to know what kind of equipment, and I think you're right. You know, so somebody just doesn't go down the aisles and start writing stuff down, which they could do for model numbers too. But I think to give them a sense of what your experience really is and get to the heart of are you really legit or not, which, you know, that'll show up in the interview too. So, well, it's exciting. We always need more good quality tree care people. So
absolutely.
Don't let that application dissuade you, though I can understand how it might.
Thanks, Ron, and good luck.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, appreciate your call. Jeff in Black River Falls, we're on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Hey. I have a question about my parents have a problem with poison oak in their soil, and they live out in the country in Black River Falls, and they've been planting a garden for like 2 or 3 decades now, and it wasn't like that in the beginning, but the past few years they've been having problems with, like, nothing will survive or make it, everything wilts away before it matures.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if it has something to do with like, my mom's always burned the garbage, and I think, and I remember that she's used the ashes before as, like, a type of fertilizer, but she burns, like, everything, and including that is probably, like, some plastics and stuff in there. And I'm wondering if that could be the cause of it, if something from the plastics has made this poison oak in the soil, and if that could be the cause, And if so, how to get rid of it, or what will be the cause?
Okay. The first thing I would probably do, from your descriptions, two things come to mind. First of all, are black walnuts, and that could explain the change over time. If there are black walnut trees growing in the area, they contain a substance called juglone in their roots, the leaves, the nuts, and everything. And, you know, I live in the city, but two houses down, somebody has a black walnut tree, and the squirrels are always planting them in my yard. So I'm always pulling out those seedlings as I find them. Now, you know, if they're out in the area, I followed the roots of a black walnut going several hundred feet away from the trunk of the tree, where, you know, and then you could see it go through the garden and plants that are susceptible. Some plants are very susceptible, and they'll tend, like tomatoes, and they'll wilt and even die. So that's one possibility. Check and see if you've got black walnuts in the area, and they may have grown over time and the roots spread, and that could be creating the problem. The second thing is verticillium wilt, which is a vascular disease that blocks the flow of water and nutrients between the roots and the top of the plants, and it has very similar symptoms to black walnut. The third is always a possibility. When you're looking for toxins in soil, it's a very difficult process because you have to say, well, I want you to test for this, this, and this, and they're very expensive tests. But you may want to start with a standard soil test, and that can tell you organic matter. I don't really recommend using ash for a couple of reasons. One, it tends to be very alkaline, which isn't such a problem in central Wisconsin because your soils are more acidic. It just doesn't tend to have a lot of value in terms of improving the soil. So, you know, you got to dispose of it somehow, but you know, I might save it for pathways or mix it in with your compost to kind of dilute it a bit. But you're right, if she's burning all kinds of stuff, that's a possibility, but I would start with the black walnut, the verticillium wilt, and there are, if you go to, listen when Brian Huddleston's on or go to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, there's some information and pictures of verticillium wilt and susceptible plants, so that's a good place to kind of see if that matches what you're seeing. And then a standard soil test is always the place I start when, you know, I look at a garden that's having issues or a landscape, and it's not a clear disease issue. Soil tests can tell you a lot, you know, what's in the soil, what, if anything, you need to add. So it can rule out some problems or it can help pinpoint things as well.
Yeah, we had an email from Genevieve in Madison who has raised beds but just noticed her neighbor's black walnut tree 30 feet away. Well, if it's 30 feet away, it's going to be affecting.
Yeah, and one of the things, which was too late for her, but people consider doing raised beds, lining it with a weed barrier. It may not keep them out forever, but it's going to slow those roots. And hopefully, you know, a good foot or so of soil above weed barrier, lined, raised bed, at least can try to help keep those roots out of that raised bed, and hopefully they'll go around and look for something someplace else to grow.
Right, and yeah, although it's awfully inviting for roots to have all that nice watered and loose
soil. Exactly. And so the weed barrier hopefully underneath will keep them out, but you're right. They you know, one little tear and they're through there and looking for that nice soil to grow in.
But I think in Genevieve's case, she could empty that soil out, put a barrier in, and put new soil back in, I guess.
Yeah, or put it, you know, move her susceptible plants. The other thing, if you do a search on black walnut toxicity, there are a couple of sites, Ohio State University, Cornell, and I think Purdue are usually the top three universities that come up with list of plants. There's nothing, you know, not every plant is listed, but it's a place to show these are tend to be really susceptible, these tend to be resistant. And then I always say try one or two. If there's something you like and it's not on a list, see if it works and then start creating your own black walnut resistant garden, at least in those areas near the black walnut tree.
It's just too bad that a lot of the most favorite vegetables and fruit, well, like tomatoes, for example, there are just no varieties that
are resistant. Exactly. So you're stuck with a pot, you're stuck with a raised bed, the other side of the garden. And in like her case, it's usually the neighbor has the black walnut. And even if you can convince them to cut it down, it can be 5 years or more before those roots disintegrate and the problem's gone. So it won't get worse, but, you know, you've got to wait for those roots to totally disintegrate before they're not a problem to susceptible plants.
Yeah. Jeff, thank you for calling. Genevieve, thanks for the email. And Norm would like to know what special care his 100-year-old rose bush would appreciate.
Wow. I think whatever he's doing.
Yeah.
Those are
keep
always,
it up.
Yes, exactly. You know, if it's 100 years old, I would say if he, you know, whatever he's doing, it sounds like it's doing fine. You know, if he's not getting the flowers, pruning can help with that. If he doesn't get flowers at all, it might be the graft has died. But if it's 100 years old, it's probably a family heirloom. You know, I remember one of my professors said the plants don't read the books. And, you know, when it's going right for you,
yeah,
just keep doing it.
Keep doing it. Diane in Birchwood, we're on to you. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hi, Diane.
I love to garden, and we built a home 3 years ago in the middle of the wood near a lake. And I would love to put in some blueberry bushes, but I'm concerned about if I'm going to be inviting more deer and more bear into my backyard and have no blueberries.
Well, I think, I don't know if you were able to hear one. I forget, was it Val that called in with advice and said she has a lot of issues with rabbits eating her blueberries. Very successful growing Patriot, but she has a lot, she has to fence them in to protect them over the winter. I definitely think if you've got a lot of animal issues, you know, anytime you bring something tasty in, it's just one more food source. Fencing, I wasn't sure if I heard you say bear or deer.
Both.
Okay. Okay, well, when it comes to bear, I don't know.
There's not much you can...
I know. I'm thinking they could probably knock over the fence. It might keep out the deer. There are some repellents. Bob-X is an all-natural product that you can spray around food crops. It's got garlic. I don't know. I haven't seen the rating for bear. It's been independent studies that show it's very effective on deer and rabbits and rodents. I'll have to check on the bear thing. But, you know, that's going to be that trade-off that you're going to have to figure out is, you're planting a picnic.
Thanks, Diane. Tom in Whitewater, on to you. Hi, Tom.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was in my car, heard you talking about sprouting, and it immediately grabbed my attention. We have a lot of family members with food allergies, and we've been exploring the world of sprouting, but no one in the family does well with the things that we've found, like sunflower sprouts, vegetable sprouts. And I'm just wondering if you know, are there any fruit sprouts you can do or any aquatic plant sprouts you can do? We're having to think a little bit outside the box.
Wow. They're not growing well for you, or they're not because of the food allergies, their issues?
We just don't tolerate them well.
No. Okay. Boy.
No.
Yeah. I had trouble finding sprouting seeds of things like radishes. I don't know if watercress. I have seen cress available at, I went to an organic food store is where I found my sprouts during the winter. Some garden centers have them, but usually it's more of a spring thing. I even hate to get into the whole eating of things that I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen any fruit sprouts. You know what? And I'm so bad at getting back to people, so I even hate to, and I have good intentions. I will do a little hunting, and I'm thinking, I don't know, and I don't even know where to tell you to go. I will just kind of put it on my radar, and if you go to info@melindamyers.com and then just nudge me as needed if I don't get back to you, I'll just do a little hunting in some of my sources. I have a friend that does some foraging, and she may have some ideas as a forager. You know, I'm just thinking outside. I have no idea, actually. So I'll just do a little hunting. And, you know, Larry always has such great guests, and I'm just going to make him promise to tell me if somebody comes on and answers that question. So we'll see what we can do. I honestly don't know, so we'll see what we can find out.
We'll see what we can come up with.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, we'll check into that. That's an interesting question.
You always have such cool guests. So somebody, I bet, out there knows. And if I find out anything, I'll let you know, Larry, so you can pass it on.
Perfect. Let's go to Marie in Appleton next. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I was told that a black walnut tree attracts lightning, and it will protect your house. That's its virtue.
No.
Well, there's always that tallest tree in the woods. There's some statistics that show certain trees are more susceptible, but I think I would not count on that being.
All right, but how about all the roots? That's what I found interesting. That, you know, it would disseminate the lightning a little bit.
Well, I think anything that's going to ground it, I you know, most trees have roots that go 2 to 5 times the height of their tree away from the trunk of the tree. And then a lot of how lightning impacts trees and how it moves through the trees is the amount of moisture in the trunk of the tree, too. That impacts how that lightning moves through the tree. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, if you have a black walnut and it's sturdy and it's not a hazard and you like it, then that's a reason to keep it with all the, you know, things we talked about being challenges with it. But, you know, counting on it keeping the lightning out of your house,
no.
I wouldn't do that.
No.
I mean, I just think you'd plant a tree for a reason, but not that one.
Not
so,
that one.
So I just am concerned that you count on it and it doesn't work for you, and know that Larry and I didn't suggest that. How's that for being a chicken here?
Thanks very much for calling, Marie. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. We have open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@WPR.org. And let's turn to emails here for a second. An email from Leslie in Hartford says, I have mountain ash that is young and made berries for the first time last year. Toward the end of the season, the leaves turned black prematurely, and the berries dried up. I don't know if the berries are supposed to do that. I suspect that this is fire blight.
Yep.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, and here's the thing with fire blight. If the whole tree, you know, I've seen, and working with a pathologist at the university, I've seen trees taken out very quickly by fire blight, but I've also seen some where a branch goes at a time, and with proper pruning where you get out there, you prune off the infected branch behind the canker, sunken, discolored area, disinfect your tools between cuts, and I've actually seen trees saved with pruning and care. Avoid excess nitrogen fertilizer because that stimulates growth that's then more susceptible to the fire blight disease. So if there are living parts to the tree, you may want to get out there and prune it, disinfect your tools, make sure you don't cut in the canker. I've unfortunately seen cases where people had done pruning and they cut accidentally into a canker and then pruned a whole row of crab apples. And you can just tell, you can just see the picture in your head, can't you, Larry?
Oh, boy.
That whole planting was just affected by the fire blight. So, you know, it's going to be maybe one of those to see what's alive and then decide if it's worth to say. I know, they're so beautiful when they fruit. They really struggle with our hot, dry summers, so that also puts them under stress. So if you end up replacing it, as much as I like European mountain ash, Korean mountain ash is a little bit different look but has really cool fruit, nice fall color, shiny bark, little harder to find, but it tends to tolerate our weather much better. And then the American mountain ash, which is a little more available as a native, and that it's a little more robust in appearance, but it gives you the same look of a European mountain ash, and that might be a better choice than the European that really kind of struggles with our hot, dry summers.
You know, Leslie also mentioned she had a tomato garden very near the mountain ash, and it had severe late blight. She wonders if there can be anything in common between the two diseases, the late blight and the fire blight.
Well, you know, a couple things. Sometimes when we have a lot of disease problems, it means weather is very conducive for disease issues to develop. Typically, many times, and I'm getting into Brian Huddleston's area here, but typically diseases have different strains that attack different plants. For example, powdery mildew that hits the lilacs is a different strain than the one that hits your grass. Now, if one's got powdery mildew and they're both susceptible, it means probably the growing conditions are good for powdery mildew, so you often see it. So late blight doesn't hit the mountain ash, but, you know, fire blight definitely can be an issue. And you know, again, it was, you know, late blight was such a big problem, you know, was it 2 years ago? That was, and then we had some remnants carry over this year. So you want to make sure you did good cleanup. You may want to even do some preventative spraying next year just to break the cycle because, you know, when it hits, it's really too hard to control. Or stay in touch with Larry's show or the Extension Service because they really are monitoring late blight around the state and giving us the heads up when we need to consider if we need to do a preventative spray if we had the problem in the past.
Let's turn to Susie in Springfield, Illinois next. Hi, Susie.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm going to start doing some raised bed/square foot gardening.
Okay.
And I'm very green focused in that I try to find old materials and use them in new ways so that they don't get thrown out. And I'm wondering what types of, I've already thought of bricks and, you know, discarded cinder blocks, but what types of wood could I use to build these that are discarded but won't poison the soil or taint the crops? Can I use old pallets? Do you have any suggestions for types of wood I should and shouldn't use in wooden raised beds?
Yeah, I think the first thing would be anything that's been used for building that's old, I would avoid. And the reason being is you don't know what the preservatives that maybe were used back then that we thought were safe that aren't. And some of them have leached out, some haven't. You know, it's like the old telephone poles, that creosote. Why go there?
Yep.
You know, and especially when you're trying to raise your own food. So I would say any untreated wood. The problem is most of that usually ends up disintegrating in the garden. I've used some untreated wood for edging and things, and it just kind of ends up joining the garden eventually,
yeah.
Which, you know, is a way to deal with it. But I think you're on target. The benefit of using stone and brick and cinder block and some of those things is it, you know, it's going to last a long time. But if you can find anybody that's maybe put in a garden recently that's tearing it out, any oak, any black locust, I know there's a lot of the Amish communities in Wisconsin do a lot of woodworking. You know, I don't know, and they use in furniture building, and they use a lot of those oak and black locust and those long-lasting cherry and things like that. They tend to be pricier. Cedar's another good long-lasting. So, you know, I don't know where you would find used materials, you know, that would be safe.
I don't know
That's
either.
My concern, and I'm worried about what they might have painted or preserved it with that could be an issue for you. So that's a good strategy, and I'm sure if any of Larry's listeners have an idea or source, they'll be calling in.
I'm sure of that. Thank you very much for calling,
Susie. Good luck.
Carol in Galena, Illinois. We're on to you now. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thanks. I am very interested in using corn gluten as a pre-emergent herbicide, and I know Gardens Alive sells WOW, and it's quite expensive, and now Preen has even come out with what they tell me is an organic corn gluten. I have an ethanol plant near me, and they sell corn gluten meal as a byproduct of the ethanol process. Is I'm sure that's GMO corn.
Uh-huh.
Is it still considered organic or not?
Well, you know, the federal government has certain very strict guidelines to what's organic and what isn't, and it starts with the soil and the pesticides being used on the soil where the crop is grown. And so since it's being used for fuel, the source of that corn, you know, if you truly want organic, if you're just saying, I want a more eco-friendly or natural weed control, that is a plant-derived product. I personally, one, can only recommend things that are labeled for that use. And then two, prefer to take, I know it's expensive. There are a lot of different companies selling it now. When you go to the garden center, if you find the Preen comes, there's several different formulations, so make sure you're getting what you want. But one of them does use corn gluten meal as a preventative. But there's Amaze, and I'm trying to think, there's like five or six brands I see out pretty regularly in garden centers. So you might want to do some comparison shopping. The prices are starting to come down, though they're still pretty high. The benefit is there's regulations on those products, so you know what's going in, and you know that was the point it was being used for and prepared for. I don't know enough about the product, the byproduct, how that compares to what's in the bag. So I'm a little nervous about saying go ahead and use it. Plus, legally, you know, it's not labeled for use as a pesticide, so I really can't recommend it that way. So I know it's expensive, but I think, you know, my theory is let them do the research, and I think we're going to see the prices keep dropping as more and more people are using it.
Yep, I do too. Melinda Myers, our guest today, gardening expert, as we talk with her on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Turned our attention to the garden today with Melinda Myers, author of more than 20 books. She's got a great website as well. Well, you know, we should talk about that, Melinda. Give us your website address first.
It's melindamyers.com, and even if you spell my name wrong, if you get close, you'll get there. And one of the things I've tried to do, and I think it's my extension background and working with folks like you, is really just trying to build a resource for gardeners, things that I get questions on regularly, things that people are interested in, trying to provide different ways you can learn, either questions and answers. We've got some videos. We've got audio tips. I do podcasts twice a month. And we've got a photo gallery. I'd love to have your listeners, the gardeners out there in Wisconsin, send photos of their favorite plant or their landscape because, you know, gardeners love to share and inspire each other. And so it's about learning. It's about inspiration. It's about sharing. And it's just a way I can keep in touch with folks and hopefully help them out and help them have fun in their garden because I think that's what it should be about and be successful, of course.
It's a great website because you have so many. I mean, you've got everything there. You've got audio. You've got video. You've got script. It's perfect.
Well, trying to reach all of our different learning styles, and I know I do my research at weird times of the day. So if you're up at 3 in the morning, I might be up, but please don't call me. But you can go to my website.
And you've got CDs, and we're actually going to be offering a couple of your CDs at our during our pledge drive that's coming up.
Yeah, and I was so sorry I couldn't join you. I'm going to be flying both days of the pledge drive. But Melinda's Garden Moments are one-minute tips, and they air throughout the country but throughout Wisconsin. And we had a lot of requests for people wanting to see them and kind of look at them at your leisure. And so Volume 2 and Volume 3 is just, we're just getting it in our hands next week, so it's fresh off the press, so to speak. And they're one-minute tips. You can, you know, you want to learn how to grow microgreens, we've got a segment on that. You want to learn how to do a windowsill herb garden, we've got a segment. Starting a garden from scratch, getting kids involved, you know, pruning and all kinds of different things, rain barrels. And so it's just a little bit of everything, a potpourri of garden tips that I always hear from people. I try to answer those questions I get a lot, things that you hear a lot too, Larry, so that people can get answers. And sometimes, you know, gardening is so visual. If you can see it, it helps make it that much more clear. And also on those cold days when I'm looking out my window at all that snow, it's just good to look at pictures of pretty gardens, too.
That's right. And I said CDs. I meant DVDs.
Right.
Obviously.
Yeah, well, that's okay. I'm a low-tech girl, too, so I wasn't going to correct you.
Oh, boy. Well, Bob in Iron River has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Larry. Thank you very much. I really love your show. And thank you, Melinda, for all the advice.
Oh, thanks.
I have a suggestion. You had a caller on just recently, and they were wondering about, I think it was bears and deer.
Yeah.
And I have bees, and I put a solar battery out there, and I put wiring around it, and the bears stay out, and the deer stay out. And also, you had another caller about putting raised gardens in, and I put one in, and I went to the local lumber yard or the sawmill, and they have all this slab wood for little or nothing. And I did mine with slab wood, and it's lasted so far 4 years, and I have no problem with it.
And it was untreated. You were confident they. I think she was. One of her concerns was preservatives and things too.
No.
So.
No, this is what you call pine.
Oh, okay, just raw pine.
Excellent. Raw pine, and it's got the bark on the edges. So.
Oh, very pretty then.
It's all natural, yeah.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Yeah. So hopefully she good suggestions. And are your lights motion sensitive? Or are they just on timers?
No, it's a solar a panel. And it has a battery in it.
Right.
And you hook that up, and you run your wires around, and once the bears and the deer come up to it, they get shocked.
Oh, it's a shock. I thought it was a light. I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
See, I have cattle, too, and I use that for my cattle to keep them in.
Okay. Wonderful.
Well, wonderful. Thank you very much.
Right. Well, thanks for sharing. That's what's the great thing about gardeners, isn't it, Larry?
Absolutely. That's a good tip. A little work to get it set up, but once you're set up,
you might get a few blueberries instead of the bears getting them.
Yeah, that's right. Christy in Eland, Wisconsin. Let's go to you. Hi.
Hi. I wondered when the best time to transplant my burning bush is. I've had it there about 5 years, but the deer keep crossing the road and munching on it, so it keeps it down to size. And so I need to move it up to by the house.
Yeah, one of the things, just keep in mind, if there are enough deer, they may come and follow that burning bush up by the house, but you're right. Hopefully that'll discourage them. Spring, as soon as, you know, before growth begins, is my favorite time to transplant, you know, when you can get out there and work the soil. but before growth begins. And the benefit of that is that's when the plants put on a lot of root growth. So if you can dig it and move it, you're going to get a lot of root growth after transplanting. You also have the spring, the cool temperatures of spring and early summer to get established. Now, a hot summer like last year is tough on transplants, so you're going to need to give it TLC, mulch the soil to keep the roots cool and moist and properly watered. The second best time is fall. You know, after the leaves drop, again, moving it, you get a good burst of root growth. You know, it depends on the winter, too. I just kind of, you know, I just always worry. Planting in the fall is great, but when you're digging up and leaving half the roots behind, it's a little tough on the plant. So if you can do it before growth begins in the spring, that would be the best time.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Marie in Wausau, on to you now. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I would like to know if I were to make a lemon poppy seed cake, can I use the seed that I collected from the poppies from last fall into the cake?
From your garden?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good
question.
Well,
and those, well, if you were growing, because those seeds come from the opiate poppy, and if you've got those, you want to make sure you've got the right poppy that's the kind that's used for baking. And I'm gonna just say, I don't know.
I mean, I don't know either.
If it's, you know, we're stepping into some scary ground for Melinda, which is cooking. So,
I do not know.
I don't know either. And I, you know, I'm thinking if there's a good food. I don't know if the Extension Service does much with food anymore. You know, they used to have a home ec program and then family living and that type of thing. And I can't think of any of your guests that come on and talk about that. That's another one that I'm going to have to do a little hunting for. But I would say, you know, you might want to go to, boy, if there's a good food, you know, a natural food store or someplace like that. I honestly don't know.
Uh-huh. We'll see what we can come up with. Maybe.
Wait, this has been a tough day, Larry.
Oh, you've answered almost every single question. But Marie, we'll see what we can come up with.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks for calling. Oh, boy. Harriet in Richland County. Let's go to you now. Hi, Harriet.
Hi, good morning. Say, I have a quick question about pruning a kiwi vine.
Okay.
I have two very large ones on the side, north side of my garage, and I've never really pruned them, and they're just getting kind of all over the place. Is there a best time to prune them, and how do you do it?
You know, kiwis are pruned very much like grapevines, and so the best time to do it is late March, depending on the weather, okay?
Yeah.
But about the time you get out there before growth begins. And then kiwis, you can train them just like you do grapes. And one of the things with grapes, if you've ever pruned grapes, is you typically have a main trunk and then, you know, two or four what they call fruiting canes, and those are the side branches. And those are pruned back so they have about 8 or 12 buds on each cane. Underneath those four, one small shorter branch is pruned because that's going to be your fruiting cane next year. So if you're looking for fruit from your kiwis, and believe it or not, you're going to prune it pretty heavy, but you'll get lots of growth, as you've discovered, each year. And then by doing heavy pruning, whether it's kiwis or grapes, because they're handled similarly, you'll get better fruit production, believe it or not, with the heavier fruiting, with the heavier pruning. And I'm assuming you're growing them kiwis for eating, not just ornamental?
They are just ornamental.
Oh, are they the Arctic Beauty kiwi?
Yes.
You know, in that case, you can still handle them the same way, because that'll help keep them down to size. But you don't have to be quite as rigorous if you're not so concerned about the fruit. So you might want to take a couple of the stems. I'm guessing you maybe a couple of main stems, and you can reduce their height, you know, down to 2 to 4 feet, and then leave some side branches on and help them, and that'll allow them to fill up. If you feel that's too drastic and you don't want to take it down that much, you can reduce the height, you know, take a few stems down pretty hard and reduce the overall height by a few feet. But you can prune them pretty hard just like a grape and really still have good-looking plant this coming growing season.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Yep, thanks for calling.
Boy, they're beautiful plants.
Yeah, they sure are. Stephen Colfax, hi.
Good morning. As mycologists with mushrooms do, sometimes they just take a small amount of the mushroom and eat it and see what happens. Maybe you could suggest that to somebody with poppies. I don't know.
Yeah, I always worry that might, you know. I always get nervous if it doesn't turn out right.
Well, I mean, There's a lot of us out here. We could replace a few of us with.
Nope, that was not Larry and I making that recommendation.
I built a raised bed planter using hog panels covered with stucco lath and masonry, like stucco plaster.
Oh, cool!
And my wife says now we can garden like old people. It's about four feet off the ground, so there's no weed issues, and you know, like 4 feet wide and 45 feet long, and
easy to reach.
At least a lifetime, maybe more. I'd suggest to that woman in Illinois that she get a hold of her local plaster contractor and have them build them, and they'll be there indefinitely.
Thank you. You know, Larry, I knew.
Yeah,
I knew
that's a great idea.
Folks would be calling in with good suggestions. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Appreciate that very much. And tell you what, we are, let's see, we are looking at Susan. Oh, I don't think we got time for Susan right now. Melinda, what's that website again?
It's melindamyers.com. And if you visit it and you have suggestions of things we should do, I'd love to hear from you. And if there's a topic for a book you're dying for, I'd love to hear from you. I have a publisher interested in working with me, and we're trying to find the right topic that works for all of you.
So if there's a
book you're dying for, I'd love to hear from you.
Well, that's something I would love to hear from that from people on that as well.
Yeah.
Melinda Myers, our guest today on this edition of Garden Talk, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just to mention, coming up at 1 o'clock today, we'll be joining NPR for coverage of Hosni Mubarak's resignation in Egypt, so I hope you will stay tuned for that. In the meantime, Melinda Myers, our guest here on Garden Talk, great to have her along. To answer your gardening questions, you can join in at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. And Bob Tomisch is with us here, Melinda. Bob.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing fine.
Great.
I thought I could share an answer with you on the poppy seed.
Oh, good. See? Excellent.
My grandmother used to grow it, and this was way back in the 30s and 40s. But anyway, when they collect the seed, if it's the opium type, which you're not allowed to grow here anymore, the cooking process kills the alkaloids that are the hallucinogen. And it also, the cooking process makes those seeds sterile. So even when you buy poppy seed commercially, they've gone through a heating process for two purposes. One is to break down that alkaloid, and the secondly is to make them non-viable for germination. They're also working on varieties that do not carry the opium qualities. And I had a former student who is a plant breeder in Denmark who had developed the line, and about the time they were ready to harvest the seeds, somebody thought they were real and went and stole the whole bunch. So he was back to point zero in his breeding program. So anyway, it is possible to produce the non-hallucinogenic type of poppy seed.
It is from the opiate poppy that you're not supposed to grow, right? So I was right on that mark. Do you know anything about fruits and sprouting fruits and eating those while we have you on?
Yeah, well, as long as you're at.
Not for that one.
Okay. Well, thank you. This is great, Bob. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Got off my list, and you took care of our list of the gardeners out there. Thanks.
Thanks, Bob. Oh, he's a good guy.
Yeah, he is. He is.
David in Columbia County, we are on to you now. Hi, David.
Hello. I thought I could add a little bit to the blueberry discussion.
Excellent.
You talked a lot about soil pH. Soil texture is real important, too. You alluded to sandy soil being better, and that's true. People could, if they have just a couple plants they want to grow, bring in sand, but they need to make sure they remove the heavier textured subsoil as well as the topsoil. And a good pH adjustment is elemental sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
You want elemental sulfur, not the aluminum sulfate. And then a couple other comments with the, there's an excellent publication by the University of Minnesota. You can Google it, something to the effect of blueberry culture for home gardening. And that focuses on the half-high varieties that University of Minnesota has developed that you referred to. But there's also some high bush. I wouldn't hesitate in Wisconsin to try raising high bush. They don't get as tall as they might in Michigan, but but you'll still get fruit, and they're nice big berries.
Yeah, and that's what I think it was Val that had mentioned. Thank you. I want to reiterate what you said about sand. If you put sand in heavy soils, you end up with concrete if you don't put enough. So you either need to put 1 inch of sand for every inch of heavy soil you amend, which most of us give up before we get to that point,
yeah,
or create a whole different mix. And you brought up a good point. You know, you may be doing a container either in a real container where you can really control the soil, or look at your bed as clearing it out and creating an artificial mix that's really suited. You know, it's that organic soils. The sands are great, the organic matter to help hold the moisture, because moisture is an issue too. So you bring up a really good point. If it's a couple that you're growing, you know, as a home gardener, it's, you can make it happen. You know, if you're doing this commercially, not real practical. And Minnesota, I just want to put a plug in for the University of Minnesota. When I'm looking for hardiness stuff.
Yeah, they're very good.
Yeah, that's what their research focuses on. And, you know, there's that good relationship Wisconsin and Minnesota have. So great plug for their publications. And so thank you. Gardener to gardener is always some good advice coming through.
Thanks, David, for calling. Appreciate it. Going back to the sprouts, and shoot seeds, Leslie in New Berlin and others have emailed in on this as well. Johnny's Selected Seeds is a great source for sprout and shoot seeds. They have a big selection. Most are organic. They all test negative for E. coli and salmonella, and that's pretty important since you often see sprout recalls due to these pathogens.
And the other thing is, if you're looking for cool vegetable varieties,
yeah,
that's a catalog. If you're not on that list, just order one catalog and you'll be on everybody's list. And it's a great way to get through winter and a great way, you know, we have some wonderful garden centers here in Wisconsin that do a nice job for us as gardeners. But, you know, they can't handle everything because not everybody wants those unusual things. So Renee's Garden, Johnny Select, the Cook's Garden, you know, some of those, Baker's, Beaver Creek Heirloom. There's some really good Seed Saver Exchange we've talked about in the past. So, yeah, thank you for the heads up on that. That's really, thank you. That's great.
Joya in Fitchburg, we turn to you now. Hi, Joya.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was going to tell about the poppy seeds, but somebody else answered it.
Uh-huh.
You know, what they do in India, in northern India, when they can grow the poppy, they take the seeds, dry them in the sun dry, like the tomatoes.
Yes.
Do sun dry, and then they cook it. So that, you know, destroys the alkaloids, which you mentioned, and also becomes edible. And the fruit also, they cook the fruit, and especially in Kashmir region, and, you know, near the Kashmir-Pakistan border,
mm-hmm,
the Kashmir region, they cook the food and they eat it with the rest of the vegetables.
Excellent. Thank you.
They destroy the, you know, whatever the, you know, alkaloids things is in there. Now, my question to Melinda is, Melinda, I have a very old clematis vine. It's just an old garden variety. It didn't do very well last summer. Now, what should I do? Should I see an experiment, see how it does this summer and spring, or get a new one?
You know, when you said it didn't do very well, what happened to it? It didn't bloom? Did it die?
I didn't have as many flowers. There is a certain time when there's a right temperature and moisture, the whole vine blooms.
Okay, but the plant looked healthy. It just didn't flower.
It had some leaves. No, it was not too healthy also.
Okay.
I don't know whether it had any, I couldn't see any fungus, anything on the bark or, you know, something.
Got it.
It just didn't thrive that well.
You know, last summer was just, you know, and I feel like sometimes people are thinking, yeah, I blame the weather, Melinda, but last summer was so, it was a very trying year. Floods, droughts, heat, extreme heat. And some plants did amazingly well and some plants didn't. And I would think if your plant overall looked healthy and it was just a lack of flowers, I would leave it. Make sure, clematis, the old saying is the face in the sun and the feet in the shade. They do like their roots cool and moist, pretty toasty last summer for many of us. So making sure you mulch it or grow some ground cover to help keep the roots cool and moist. If you have some dead branches, you know, we prune clematis to control the size. Late winter, early spring, here in Wisconsin, we're typically growing those that bloom on new growth in summer and or fall. so we can prune those back in late winter, take out anything that's dead. That will stimulate, and then avoid high nitrogen fertilizers because too much nitrogen gives you lots of growth but no flowers. I wouldn't rip it out yet. You know, last year was a very trying weather year, and the plant looked healthy. You know, you've got an established root system, so I think I would just try to make sure it's, the soil's moist but well-drained, the roots are cool, and avoid any high-nitrogen fertilizer that might interfere with bloom.
There you go. Thanks, Joya, for calling. Appreciate it. John in Boston. On to you now. Hi, John.
Hi, Melissa. Hi, Larry. I have a question. I have a mature, very productive raspberry patch. I've got about four rows, and they're getting a little unruly and kind of hard to keep. And I'm curious if I can, I had heard from some old timers that you can mow them down in like the coldest time in February and that they'll resprout in the spring. And I don't want to take a chance without expert advice.
Okay, well, here's the deal. If raspberries are pretty tough, and if they're fall-blooming raspberries, they bloom on the first season growth. And many people that have fall-blooming raspberries cut them right back to the ground fall or winter, and then they get new growth, and you get an earlier and heavier crop in the fall, but you eliminate the summer crop. If they are summer or ever-bearing, the summer crop comes on two-year-old canes. So those are the canes that sprouted last spring, grew, and then they're going to have fruit on them this coming summer. If you cut those back to the ground, you've eliminated the fruit for the summer. So your plants will live, but you'll eliminate the fruit if it's a summer-bearing type, okay? Now, what you can do is thin them out and take out so you've got the, you know, old canes that had fruit last summer right back to the ground. Start there. Anything that's damaged, start thinning it out to about four or five canes per foot of row. And that's one way to get it. I know it's, and you want to do that in the cold because you have plenty of clothes on to protect your skin.
Right.
And I know it's putsy, but that way you'll thin it out, fewer disease, better productivity, and it might get them back under control in the summer after that crop, after it has its summer crop. Prune those out right back to ground level. That makes thinning in the winter a lot easier, and it then keeps the plants better producing and fewer disease problems. So they'll survive. The plants will survive. You just won't get a summer crop. So that's the downside.
Okay.
Okay. I understand. Well, great. Thank you very much.
Hey, good luck with that.
Nancy in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I have a question about black currants. I just love them. They make good juice and you can make tremendous pies, especially if you add some walnuts into the pie.
Mm. You're making me hungry between raspberry talk and the currant talk.
And you can also make a tremendous wine from them.
Yeah.
But my husband said that he heard that they're invasive.
Well, what he's probably heard about black currants is they're an alternate host for white pine blister rust. And there was a period, and I'm not... If you look at certain catalogs that sell them, they don't sell into states, and Wisconsin was on that list.
Oh, I see.
I'm not, you know, check the source, and that's why we typically don't see the black currants, because there's a concern that we are such a big timber state in the past with white pine, and so there's some restrictions, and I think we're still on that restricted list, if I remember correctly.
We are?
I think. Check. I was going to look. I'm not in front of my computer right now, just to see if you can find a source for black currants. Garden catalogs will tell you where you can't buy them.
I was able to buy them through the Indiana Berry Booker.
Okay. Well, then you got them. So, yeah, I would just, if you have a white pine nearby, that's a concern.
Oh, okay.
Because it is an alternate host. So if you've got a hold of them, that's what he's probably thinking of. Not invasive, but alternate host for white pine blister rust.
Yep. And it might, even though you got them from Indiana.
They may have just slid them across the border is what you're thinking too, Larry.
Yeah.
Didn't want to slam our neighbors, but.
Yeah, you better check on that.
Yeah, you know, and that's in, yeah.
And thanks for calling, Nancy. Beth in Milwaukee will turn to you next. Hi, Beth.
Hi, yeah, Melinda and Larry, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I have a very curious son, and there was a Curious George show about Curious George planting all sorts of things in the dirt, and so that's what my son did when he was about three or four, and he planted, one of the things he planted was an apple seed.
Okay, so now you have an apple tree.
Yeah. And so now he's eight, and so this some of the things that he planted didn't grow, but the apple seed did. And so now I'm just wondering about planting that out in the yard. I mean, I think it's got to be about, 3 or 4 years old. I don't even remember because we kind of ignored it, and it was still alive, and we would water it, and, you know, so it's just been in the house for 3 or 4 or 5, I don't even know, 5 years, and it's even got a little sprout tree growing. I don't know if I'm saying the terms right, but so I was wondering how to successfully plant that outside now.
You know, that's a really good question, and think of it just like you do when you start flowers indoors. You're going to need to harden it off, so come spring, after the danger of frost, because it's been living inside in wonderful care, you're going to take a couple of weeks to gradually introduce it to the outdoors. So put it in a shady spot, a little bit of light every day, a little more each day. You're going to let the soil go slightly drier than you've been keeping it indoors if you're, you know, don't fertilize during this period. And then you have two choices. You could grow it in a pot and then, you know, either put the pot in an unheated garage. You could find a permanent spot in your yard. It sounds pretty tiny yet, so you'd probably want to fence it just to protect it from the mower and kids playing and pets and things like that and any animals that might want to munch on it. So just a cylinder of hardware cloth around it, you know, so that you could protect it that way. That's why some people will put it in a pot, grow it in a protected place, sink the pot in a vacant pot of the part of the garden for winter, so it's easier to care over winter by letting nature do it. Pull that pot out in the spring and then plant it as it gets bigger. So treat it like you would just moving an annual or perennial that you started indoors outside, gradually get it used to it, and then decide, is it big enough to move to a permanent spot, or are you better off growing in a container for a few more years, giving it extra protection over the winter, because those roots need to be protected either by being buried, the whole pot, or in an unheated garage. And then once it gets a little more structure and a little more strength and is more visible, might be a time to put it out in the garden.
Okay. I'm sorry, what do you mean by putting it in a pot?
In a pot, in a container. So
planting it in the ground, but put it in a bigger pot and keep it outside?
If you're concerned about, because it's a small size, so like nurseries do. So some nurseries grow in the field and harvest their trees. Some grow in containers. And so what you would be doing, if you put it in a container,
okay,
you would be able to control the water, give it a
right.
little more sheltered place
right.
until it gets bigger.
I see.
Okay. But over winter, you'd need to sink that pot in the ground so the roots don't freeze.
I see.
Okay. You could plant it outside, but that's where I would probably give it a little protection, because I'm guessing from your description it's pretty small.
It's about 20 inches high.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just one of those things that it's easy to miss if you're putting it out in the middle of the
right.
yard in the grass.
Okay.
If it's in a garden area, it's probably going to be okay. And then animals do like those tender young fruit
yes.
trees too. Yeah. So you might want to, and especially since he grew it from seed,
yeah.
want to give it a little protection.
Yeah, okay,
from the
great.
Rabbits.
Thank
right.
you.
Yep, thanks
Good
a lot,
luck.
Beth. Jared in Lodi, your turn. Hi, Jared.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. Thank you for calling.
How can we help?
My question is I've heard most people talk about trying to keep deer out. I'm an avid whitetail hunter, a bow hunter. And I've acquired some land in northern Wisconsin, and I've had some suggestions from my grandfather and some other fellow hunters that to try to plant some apple trees to kind of help
right.
bring some deer into the area. And I guess my question is there a specific type of apple tree and any procedures on growing them maybe in the woods rather than in a garden that may produce fruit later in the season and keep the fruit on the tree, per se? And because I'm on a cell phone, I guess I'll just take the answer off air and listen, if that's okay.
That's right. Great. And, a lot of hunters I know do use apples to bring in the deer. And a couple things. You'll want to protect that apple tree early in its life, because if you're putting it somewhere where there's a lot of wildlife,
You know, buck rubs on the trunk, rabbits eating the base, voles damaging it. So you're going to want to give it a little protection to get the plant up and growing. It takes 5 to 7 years of age before they really start producing good, bright sunlight. You know, if you put them in the wooded area, the heavy woods, they're not going to flower and fruit as readily because they do better in full sun. So openings in the woods or areas like that, you know. So, and then in terms of any, I think anything that's going to produce fruit is going to work for you. You may want to look at when they ripen so that you get something that's going to be ripening at the time that, you know, that's going to help get those deer into that area for you. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that, Larry, because you're a hunter, right? And
no, I think I think your advice is pretty good.
Okay. So, and I think the good news is you don't care about disease and insect problems. It'll be the easiest apples anybody can grow.
Yep, absolutely. And Susan in Oregon, we go to you right now. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm calling again about poppy seeds. There seems to be a lot of interest in poppy seeds.
Yeah.
And years ago, it seemed like up north where my grandparents lived, every garden you'd see rows of poppy seeds, you know, poppies growing, and they baked with them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I don't live up north, so I don't really know if it's kind of dying up there, too. But I tried finding seeds in this area, in the Madison area, and, you know, the seed stores didn't sell poppy seeds. And then I started thinking, well, it's because of this problem with the opium plants and that. But now when I called earlier, the person answering your phone said that Seed Savers sells poppy seeds to grow. And I'm just wondering, I haven't checked that out yet, but I'm just wondering if you know very much about people using poppy seeds in baking anymore. It seems like it was a real common thing years ago. I don't know if people are growing poppy seeds in their garden much and if they're cooking with poppy seeds. And is Seed Savers the place to go for seeds, or are there other avenues?
Well, I think as Bob mentioned, it's illegal to grow opium poppies.
Yep.
You know? So people that have them have probably gotten them from relatives, you know, passed along, or they've been in the garden. And so that's why you're not finding them available. And that's probably why we're not seeing people use them. Now, I don't know that Seed Savers, I'm going to have to check when I get off.
I think
here.
Judith checked and found them at Seed Savers.
And they were the opium poppies or the... Cause that's,
didn't say.
Yeah. So they, I mean, they may have poppy seeds, but you want to make sure they're the right type of poppy seeds. Too. So that might be something to check because of the legal status. That's why, some kind of special dispensation. And as Bob was sharing, which was, this is why I love to hear from our specialist at the university, is the research going on that they're trying to develop some where it won't be an issue so we can start growing them ourselves and eating them. So it sounds like, well, we may be a few more years since they lost their crop, but it looks like that's something on the horizon to consider. So maybe it'll come back.
Judy in Prairie Farm emailed in and said that you mentioned, of course, a drip irrigation system using water from a rainwater collection system. She says, my husband and I are planning to set up a system, but we've had trouble finding information on setting a system like this up online. Or you're wondering if you had a resource on the web or in books.
You know, here's a couple places I would go. Rainbird and Toro do some home gardener drip irrigation, DripWorks is one I'm going to try this year. I've got a kit on my back porch waiting for me to get it installed in my garden this spring. So now I've said it out loud, I better do it. DripWorks is a very common homeowner one. So you might want to Google DripWorks, Rainbird, and Toro on drip irrigation systems. Aquascapes is doing a lot on rainwater harvesting. Now, their systems are pretty intense, and they're, you know, it's kind of like if you're doing a whole landscape, but you might be able to take some ideas away from that. Handy people, I know a few people. I met a woman yesterday at the home improvement show whose husband put 5 bright blue rain barrels in front of their house, much to her dismay, hooked up pumps, and so he's got water pressure and irrigation, and, you know, he's really created this whole system. So there are people that are handy doing it themselves, some commercial systems available.
Oh.
And there's a new company, I think it's Rain Savers, that has a rain bench, another project on my list to do, that instead of a barrel, so I'm putting all my sins out here for you guys to hear, but a barrel, instead of a barrel, it's a bench. So you collect your water there, and it works just like a rain barrel, but it's pretty and you can sit on it.
Melinda, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today. Melinda Myers, our guest. Thank you for listening, and stay with us on the Ideas Network.